No?
No.
No.
What is it?
It's the side sheet, there's people not here.
All right, so we are talking now about the possibility of you and a delineator between selling pencils on the corner out of a tin cup or having plenty of money to buy all the things that you need 40 years from now. But Dr. Fox, it's so far away, I can go ahead and buy those 22-inch chrome wheels, or at least rent them, for my 1972 Buick. Or I can put the money in the bank. Let's see, chrome wheels, money in the bank, pay off in 40 years, chrome wheels, which will be dissolved in 40 weeks. Which one? Well, I'm trying to put you on the straight and narrow toward long-term wealth accumulation. Is anybody against long-term wealth accumulation? No. So I have you all on my side to start with. The question is, what do you have to give up to do this?
No.
That's a little bit of an issue. But we're talking about voluntary benefits. Well, you know, I used to have a long discussion on health care, but we don't need to think about that very much in terms of voluntary benefits anymore, because we're under the Affordable Care Act and companies with whatever 50 or more employees have to provide it. So we've eliminated a lot of that consideration. But voluntary benefits mostly now, in my mind, are focusing on the idea of understanding money and what it means to you long term. Because I don't want to be I don't want to be carried down the street in my coffin, you know, and push the lid up and look out and see you with a tin cup selling pencils, okay? That's not what I think would be a good way to life. So I don't want to spend my time in a coffin watching you sell pencils. So we're talking about voluntary benefits. And there's tons of stuff here that companies can use. Why do they do this? They do it because they think that it will help them
entice you to come work for them.
These are all the short term. What's the long term of this? Why do we do anything at the company in terms of intervention? To reach our goals, precisely. So we consider that voluntary benefits are going to help us achieve our goals. Right? And we do this only for that reason. We don't do it because we're friendly, nice people. Shannon took my class from me, and I was just yelling at him. So, what we have then is this idea that whatever we're giving to the employees should be part of our strategic plan. That includes, remember how I talked to you about required benefits? And they can be used to help the company achieve its goals by using Social Security appropriately, unemployment insurance, using temps and whatnot, workers' compensation, blah, blah. So all, even the required benefits can be used toward goal achievement. And voluntary benefits are much the same way. If you're offering something to employees, it needs to reinforce the point of moving toward goals. And so from that point of view, anything we put in here should be attracting people that we want to attract. And that should be something like, if I put in here, we're going to have, let's say, mortgage loans at a low rate. Who's going to be interested in that?
People buying houses.
People buying houses, which are who?
Young adults.
People in late 20s, maybe. They're tired of living at home in the basement. Their parents won't move out of the house, so they can't take it over. And so what we have here is the necessity for them to buy a house so that their kids can kick them out of it eventually. So we're looking here at the idea of perhaps attracting young 28-plus-year-old people, right, who might have had some work experience, have a fairly current degree, right, and might be up on the necessary technology for the organization. And if I'm offering low-cost loans, car loans, let's say, who might that be useful for, particularly?
You.
People coming right out of college.
We've got 1% loans now.
People coming right out of college.
Yeah, I think so, because you need something to drive around in instead of that old beater, right? Because you used to always call your friends up and say, well, it blew up again, give me a ride. Now, I'm just encouraging you, if you buy a new car, don't buy some hot rod. Buy a reasonable car like my student Chris Butler did. What did he buy? He's like 24 years old. What did he buy? A Subaru Forester. Isn't that great? It's like the bottom of the cool line. Right. You can't get any more uncool.
PT Cruisers.
PT Cruiser. They don't make
that. That's a bomber.
That is the bomber.
That's the bottom of
when
the
that car came out with a four-cylinder motor, everybody knew it was dead. They came out with a four-cylinder motor. If they put a rip-snorting V8 in that car, maybe.
Maybe.
But with four-cylinder, no. It wasn't going anywhere with that motor in it. And the Viper, not the Viper, that one, the Stealth. What a stupid car.
Drive that thing.
Stealth, you know, with the open wheels, little fenders on it. They tried to make it look like a 1930s hot rod.
Prowler,
that's the word.
Yeah, that was
kind of stupid. That didn't sell either. All right, so low-cost loans to attract people that need cars, maybe just out of school. They don't have much, you know, in the way of cash. They need a loan. They're going to buy a cheap car that'll be get them around, you know, typical Yaris or something. Yaris. So all of this stuff should be predicated on attracting a certain type of people that will want this particular benefit. However, in order to attract everyone in some way that might be useful toward holding on to employees, we have what's known as a cafeteria approach. Cafeteria benefit system in which you're given some money and you walk down a line, so to speak, right, of benefits, laying out money for particular benefits that you find useful. Right. So you can put out X number of dollars for fire insurance on your house or some such, whatever. So the company provides a planopy, a wide range, of benefits that you can choose from. And then the company pays for it up to the point of the amount of money they've given you, $400 a month or whatever. The only problem with this, of course, is, let's say you're offering maternity benefits. Who is going to take maternity benefits insurance?
Women that are pregnant.
Women who are going to have babies, right?
Yeah.
Which is like an insurance where everybody is going to collect on it, right? But who's going to buy this stuff just for fun, right? You're going to buy it because you're going to use it, which means that everyone that gets it is going to use it. Well, what's the insurance company going to say? It's not a good deal for the insurance company unless they charge a whole shipload of money, right, to cover the premiums because everybody's going to cash in on the premium. It's like you buy automobile insurance and everybody that buys insurance tells the insurance company they're going to crash their car. It's just for fun. We can't help it. We just want to crash our car. And so the insurance company knows that everybody's going to crash their car, so obviously they're going to raise the premiums to cover the expenses. So with cafeteria plan, people buy insurance and stuff that they need specifically and are probably highly likely to cash in on it. So that's an issue in terms of paying for this. But I still think cafeteria benefits are an attractive feature for employees. Remember, on these things, the reason the companies do this, aside from attracting people, is they write these costs off the bottom line, profit line, right? You know this. All right, so the company's going to write these costs off the bottom line, which, if they're careful, keep good records, et cetera, is going to also prove to be a strategic advantage because they'll have less taxes to pay, blah, blah. And this goes for all the various other things that companies offer, legal services, parking spots, company membership in the golf course, et cetera. All of this stuff can be written off the bottom line if There's a big if there. If you're writing notes, be sure to unlock. Oh, here. If people are very careful about distributing this across the employees without much differentiation. If the differentiation between, for example, a life insurance policy that a worker's offered versus the face value of the insurance policy that the CEO is offered, if there's a huge discrepancy, they're not going to be able to write it off. So they have to be what's known as non-discriminatory. This has nothing to do with race, creed, color, national origin, gender, disability, etc. This has to do with, is the policy roughly equal for all members of the organization? If you offer country club membership only to the upper echelons of your organization, it's not going to be tax deductible. It's not going to be off your taxes so that you don't pay as much tax. Off your profits so you don't pay as much taxes. So, if you offer life insurance at 5x annual salary, let's say, and keep that all the way up to the top, then that's going to be okay. But if you say 5x for the run-of-the-mill employee and 50x for the boss, it's not going to work in terms of non-discrimination for the IRS. So be careful about how you spend this money. If you're going to write it off, it has to be equally available to everyone from male room, boy, girl, to up the line. Not exactly equal, but proportionately, let's say. Okay, now I can get what I really want to talk about, the idea of money accumulation. Money accumulation, which, by the way, includes Social Security, because there's a few games that you can play with Social Security that are worthwhile knowing about as well. What we're talking about here is investing now to reap the future benefits 40 years down the road, which, of course, is a hard thing for you guys to think about. It certainly was a hard thing for me to think about. I remember thinking that whenever there was ever any problem financially, I'd just call my parents up and they'd send me a lot of cash. That was totally normal for me. But, and eventually, you know, when you start asking $10,000 or $20,000 at a shot, then it slows down a little bit. And so you got to start thinking about doing this for yourself. How do you do this for yourself?
A job
is how you do it. And particularly what's associated with the job, which is
money.
How do they give you money from
paycheck.
Your job?
Paycheck.
That's part of it, but what's the actual voluntary benefit that they don't have to offer, but do?
Like a 401k.
There you go.
Like
we're talking about 401s particularly. These are contributions that the company makes on a percentage basis of your paycheck. But they don't contribute 1 cent if you don't contribute yourself. So typically what we're talking about here is 6% of your pay. So if you contribute 6% of your pay, the company will match that contribution. Got me? And they'll follow that quite often all the way down. So that if you contribute 0% of your gross pay, what's the company going to contribute?
0%.
Yeah, right. It begins with a zero as well.
Like a maximum how much you can contribute?
Roughly 6%. The company needs to contribute. That's the maximum they'll do. You can contribute more, but it won't be matched.
If I got to $115,000 on your salary, would that?
That sounds like Social Security to me.
Oh, yeah.
What's the deal here? Why, guys, when you're contributing to this, what's the advantage of doing it in a 401 format? It's pre-tax, unless you're into a Roth program. Now, you're going to have to get your financial advisor to talk to you about whether or not you should invest it as a Roth account or as an individual IRA. Roth is taxed initially, but never in the future. The way I did it, and the way it's always been done, is you just put in raw numbers and deal with the taxes at the end. Which way's better? He can't know. I just went with the conservative way, which is to say get as much as I can now and invest it in something that seems reasonably strong long term. All right. So as this money is being matched, right, you're going to put in, the company is going to put in, the organization, and you're going to create this 401 pool. Now, let me give you an example. This is really impressive to me. So one of the first retirement program I hear at ASU went into TIAA CREF, which is like the National Teachers Organization or whatever, and they invest money. So I invested of my own money, let's just say rough numbers, $50,000 over a period of about 8 years before I abandoned them and went, for diversification's sake, went to another company, which meant that the school also put in about $50,000. But my contribution was, let's just say, $50,000. That's now worth over $200,000. Pretty good. Pretty good use of $50,000, in my opinion. 4 times return, some of it from the school and some of it from just long-term investment aspect of this. What's the downside? The downside is of any kind of 401, it's almost always controlled what you can invest in. So if you want to take a flyer on investing in online gambling, right, so you've decided to put $300,000 into online gambling companies, you might lose it all. You know, or you take all your money and convert it to bitcoins. How's it working out? It went up for a while, but how's it doing now?
Crashed.
I think it's pretty trashed by
still
now.
Still crashing.
Still, yeah. So somebody made a whole lot of money off of it, but it wasn't you, right, most likely. Like anything else, timing is impossible. So you want a solid long-term growth possibility here. So you're accumulating all this money. A couple concerns that you have, of course, is that eventually it's going to be taxed. Taxed out there 40 years out. And whether or not you should have Rothized it down to, let's say, $800 on $1,000, or should you have kept it going straight through at $1,000, that's something you're going to need to talk to advisors about who do not get a commission. Don't talk to people with commissions, then of course they're going to sell you what they happen to have to sell. But this money is accumulated and allows you to hopefully accrue in very limited types of investments because they have a real tight control on these things. You can't take flyers. You have to invest in solid, conservative stuff. We're talking 3 or 4% return. So it's not a heck of a lot of money that you're allowed to work with them. So be careful about how you do this. So this money's accumulating. And we'll talk about accumulation here in a minute. You can also, on the side, create your own individual retirement accounts, which you would take pre-tax also, right? And that money would then be put into an IRA, which may or may not have strict controls on what you can invest in. You can do up to, $15,000, $16,000 a year, something like that, in the accounts with them.
Yeah.
Is that about what it is? Do you know?
I took the personal finance class. That was the summer. I think it was 15.
Roughly like that. And, of course, I would encourage you to do that as well. Put everything you can into this because it's going to accumulate. Now, what's the downside of this, of all of this?
Can't use it.
What's going to be?
After 50?
Pardon?
You can't draw any of that money until you're after 50?
Well, you really wouldn't want to draw any of it until you're retired, because when you're working, you don't need it. Just so keep accumulating as long as you possibly can. But there's some issues here.
If the market crashes, you lose your shirt.
That's why they want you to be in conservative investments, and so that you won't come panhandling to them about this. The other aspect of this is, of course, that this money is being eroded. What's it being eroded by?
Inflation.
Inflation. Which brings me to a discussion of the Rule of 72. I can't tell you how important this is. If you take anything from school aside from job analysis, cornerstone of human resource management, you have that. You got the tattoo, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Absolutely.
This would be the next one. Just have a big 72 on your arm. Boy, all the young ladies would want to know what that was about. So there, right away, you're going to start up conversations with people that would be really cool. What is it? Do you remember? From your personal finance?
The amount of time it takes you to
every
investment.
You take 72 and?
Divide by the interest.
Divide by the interest rate, which is how quickly?
Or the number of periods.
Yeah. Yeah, the number of periods it takes for it to double, usually a year. And what that comes down to is a very handy way of impressing yourself with how money can really accumulate rapidly. And you should be aware. Right now, you're sitting thinking, well, if I get 6%, which you can't get anymore, let's say you're getting 4%, you might get. So we're dividing 4 into 72, and you're coming up with 18? No. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Your money doubles every 18 years, which seems like an impossibly long period of time. How can I possibly not buy those chrome wheels for 18 years that I have to wait for those wheels? You know why? Because you're getting all kinds of enjoyment and comfort out of looking at that spreadsheet. It's the most fun in the world to watch that number goes up over time. I can't explain to you the enjoyment of watching your money accumulate, which is why you don't need to buy the chrome wheels. A very temporary enjoyment. Whereas a climbing bottom line is always enjoyment. Always. So, my point is here to think about this in terms of doubling periods. And take the interest rate. And what you're going to have here, divided in, and that'll be the period of time, right, in some measure, that allows your money to double. So you're starting off with $1,000, 18 years later it's worth $2,000. That's not very exciting, Dr. Fox. Well, it starts to get exciting if you have enough time. So we're at $4,000, et cetera. We have, I can't even remember what the principal is on it. I think it's $100,000. In a returning, guaranteed return of 8%, what's the first thing I did? Yeah, they guarantee a return in 10 years or sooner, which will obviously be sooner. Pretty good. So the 100,000 turns into 200, and we're not going to touch it because it's our inflation hedge. That then becomes 400,000 in 2028. That's pretty good. Do I need the chrome wheels? Not particularly, but it's nice to see that thing accumulating. Yeah, it's useful amount. At the same time, it's being eroded by the opposite of this, right? Take the inflation rate, stick it under there, and that's where your purchasing power is disappearing. So if you have a 2% inflationary rate, right, you're losing half the value of your money in 36 years. Got it? So think about it both ways, accumulation as well as erosion of your money. Because inflation is sort of a vague term until you do that, then you say, Jesus, they're taking half my money away by inflating things. Too many dollars chasing too few goods, right? That's inflation. So what we're looking at here is a very useful tool to inspire you, I hope, to accumulate cash as much as possible and as quickly as possible. It's never any enjoyment to me to watch, that's for sure. If you have to, take one stock that looks like a total flyer, whatever it might happen to be. Your chance of getting making money off it is low, and spend $10,000 on that. Use that to assuage your need to gamble, right? And don't put any more in, no matter what. Just use that to punish yourself with. Glad I didn't put more in than that. Seemed like a great idea at the time. I'm still riding one of those 6 years later. I've had 15,000 shares of this stock. My basis is 45,000, and I'm just waiting. It's now at half what I bought it for.
Why don't you just take 500, go up to Cherokee, gamble for a couple of hours, and come home?
Because this seemed like the best idea ever, I told you. It's a projector in your freaking phone, so you can project your pictures onto the wall. Is that the coolest idea? Yes, Dr. Fox, it is. And it's a laser-driven, so it doesn't have to be focused. You just wave it around. It's going to be focused all the time. It's totally cool, but they can't make any freaking money out of this thing.
No way. It's way too expensive.
It's not actually. They've got it down to like $80 a unit or something.
Really?
And it's getting down there as things get cheaper, you know. Sony has a contract with them. UPS has a contract with them. All these contracts are accumulating. Does the stock budge? No. If it goes up, everybody sells it short, you know, and drives it back down again. So I've been waiting. Anticipating.
Watch it.
It'll get there eventually.
Yeah. So if they ever come out with a projector, a laser projector in this phone, chances are I finally can start throwing money around in a careless fashion. Maybe I can buy a new Outback with 22-inch chrome wheels on it.
There you go. You get a raise and put like 30.
I don't like those. I drove one of those. I didn't like it. The RAV4?
No, I said.
Oh,
raise.
You should get a raise. All right, so that's what we're doing with this. Voluntary benefits, important. Finally, let me talk to you about disciplining. Disciplining is the idea of what?
Making you put the money away monthly instead of going and blowing it on.
Yeah, that's discipline. But in terms of the organizational disciplining of an employee, what's the point?
Keep them in line.
By, I'm going to get you to use the P word.
Punish?
Punishing them. And when people say that, then I can jump up and down on them and tell them how wrong they are. Thank you for doing
this. I sacrifice myself.
Yeah.
Do I get a name?
Because it's not about punishment. Discipline is not about punishment. If you have to have another, God, I'm running up the tattoos today. Can you get that on your arm, too? Is there still room? Discipline is not about punishment. What's it about?
Determine.
What's it about?
Change.
Change, right. And what we want to be sure to do is to create an environment that doesn't sound like punishment, but does sound like encouragement for change. And how do we explain that to an employee? We have rules in place, Harry. We have these rules in place in order for the company to achieve its goals and to be successful, make money, and keep everybody employed. Because you're half an hour late three times a week, it makes us hard to do that. Work backs up behind you, or customers don't get served, or whatever it might happen to be, and that makes us difficult, makes it difficult for us to achieve our goals. Consequently, our quarterly reports and annual reports look like crap, and so we have to get you back on board. How are we going to do that? And Harry says, well, you've talked to me about it, now I understand. You put that in. It's called progressive discipline now. We take that first verbal warning, stick it in the box. That's a warning. Next is a written warning outlined in the same details. But all the time that we're doing this, we're creating, as much as possible, a support for change. Do we want to get rid of this guy? Probably not. If we can get rid of these bad habits, then we'll have an employee that should help us get to our goals. Now, granted, there are some employees that are only interested in helping themselves achieve their goals, and that may not work. But in general, we're looking for reasonable ways to move a person into compliance. For example, just after this last class, a student told me that he came to work Friday some while ago, dressed in usual casual company t-shirt, and the boss told him, did you get the email? We have to start dressing up all the time. You should be wearing, go home and get a coat and tie, or whatever the hell it was. It's like a 20-minute ride. Right? And by the way, that driving time doesn't count on your hours worked. Right? So essentially, we're punishing a person for doing this.
Plus gas and wearing time.
Plus all that. It's just stupid. Instead, what should have been done is said to whatever the kid's name was, Joe, come on over here. It was a clothing store. Come on over here. Let's see how you look in one of these jackets. You take a couple jackets off the rack. You put them in these jackets. And you say, God, you're GQ material there, buddy. Right? Why don't you wear this around today? And he'll walk around and maybe he'll feel good about wearing a coat and tie or whatever. I certainly never did at the high school. Kindergarten on, we had to wear a damn tie. So what we're looking at here is the idea of making this guy feel better and helping him comply, right? Because chances are he'd never heard from what he said. He'd never heard about this change. they wore a Hawaiian shirt in or whatever. All right, so instead of punishing the guy, sending him home, blah, blah, instead, you know, lend him a coat out off the rack or whatever it might happen to be. Show him how cool he looks in this jacket, or tie, or whatever it might happen to be. And then remind him that we need to be dressed appropriately for the rest of the week, Mondays and whatnot. So punishment is not what we're doing. What we're doing is encouraging change here. What does that mean? It means that you can't be the usual weak, trembling mass of protoplasm and insecurities that we all are, right? And instead, you've got to have your act together on how to move change forward in an employee. Go home and kick the dog instead, but don't kick to the employee. No, I didn't mean go home. Unless you're going home to kick the dog.
No.
Instead, what you're looking at here is, I have to talk about exceptions here for a minute, is to move forward taking your personal problems somewhere else as a manager, right? All right, now, in terms of termination here, which would be the end result of progressive discipline, termination is a last step. Something with an employee that can't be reconciled to goal achievement. This employee doesn't have the abilities, doesn't want to learn the abilities, doesn't have the motivation, is a general jerk, whatever it might happen to be. So termination is only the end result. Now, if you come to the point where you need to terminate an employee, I want to strongly encourage you to talk to other people, particularly your supervisors, HR, legal representation, or whatever the company has, about terminations. It's extremely complicated. There's tons of reasons why you cannot fire employees, and you need to be fully aware of that because it's an expensive process to do it wrong. Let me give you some of the exceptions. First, you know about statutory exceptions. In other words, legal exceptions. You can't fire someone because they're a woman or because they're Hispanic or whatever. Those are statutory restrictions on terminations. Right, so those exist for somebody who says, this place isn't safe, OSHA laws, right, health and safety laws. This place isn't safe. If I work here, I'm afraid I'll get hurt. I walked off a job when I was about your age because we're working with a townhouse. Here's the townhouse. One side had its building torn down. These are row houses, right, in Philadelphia. So one side had been torn down. And guess what the other side was about to have happen when I decided to go home for a week? They're going to tear down the other side, which means a house that was never supposed to stand by itself would now be, supposedly, yes.
No, it wouldn't be.
Then, before they did anything to support that, they tore the front off. You don't want to be anywhere near this. So I said, I can't do this. He said, oh, sorry, go home for a week, you know, and come back and see if the building's still here. And it was, as a matter of fact, amazingly enough. But I left because I thought it was unsafe. That would be an OSHA concern. They couldn't really fire me or even dock my pay, for that matter. Okay, so that's statutory limitations. There's also common law, judge-made law. Have you heard of this? Judge-made, it's judge interpretation of existing laws, of things that you can't be fired for. Let's say, I said, Anna, do me a favor on your way home. Take this Bowie knife and slash the tires on our competitive truck on the way home. You'll see three or four of them out making deliveries. Just pull up next to them, stab this Bowie knife into the sidewall, not the tread, but in the sidewall, because that really ruins the tire, and then just go on, pick up another one, just maybe four or five trucks, you'll see them. And you say, I don't want it done, Fox. I think it's illegal, it's wrong. And I say, you're fired, right? That would be a violation, because it's what's known as public policy. You can't fire people who are refusing to do something that's illegal, right? So that's important to consider. Also the concept of concerted activities, employees acting together, concert means two or more, right? So if two employees say, we're not going to work here because it's too cold in the warehouse to do work, you can't fire them. They're protected under the National Labor Relations Act, which was originally for unionization. You know, employees getting together to form a union, you can't fire employees that want to do that. Well, now when they come together for mutual aid and protection, as unions were, for the idea of protecting themselves against freezing to death in the factory, or in the warehouse, whatever, you can't fire those guys either, or gals. So they have this concerted activities protection here. There's also the idea of employment at will. Employment at will is the idea that you can fire anybody at any time for any reason, and the employees can quit at any time for any reason. Okay. So what we're looking at here is supposedly a loose relationship that anybody can split up if they want. What percentage of the time is it employee versus employer, would you think, in terms of breaking an employment relationship? And not as hard because you guys are in this sort of transitory way. But after you've worked at a place for 5 years, right, what's the percentage relationship between companies splitting it up or the employees splitting it up? Do you have any idea? Pardon?
Is that usually the employee?
Almost always the employer, because the employees need the security. And the employers are looking to cut costs, get better people, get somebody who doesn't diss their children or whatever, et cetera. So what we're looking at here is the idea of, you can break relationship with your employer or employee is really misrepresentation. It kind of protects the company from allowing them to fire you whenever they want. And yes, it does allow you to quit whenever you want, but the percentage is not very much in favor of the employee at all. Okay, so we have here this idea that the employer can fire you at any time, but there are other exceptions, what are known as handbook exceptions. How many of you have taken a job? When you took the job, they showed you the employee handbook and had you sign the last page. Have you seen this happen? Have you had that happen? All right. Mm-hmm. When you signed that page, you were saying, in effect, that nothing in the handbook is a contract. If you read that page, if you have access to it anymore, you'll see that it's saying nothing in this handbook implies anything but an employment at will relationship. In other words, no contractual relationship. Just because they say they're going to do something doesn't mean they have to. It's not a contract. So, for example, if you say you follow progressive discipline, which means verbal warning, written warning, suspension, termination, right? And that's in the handbook. What's going to happen if it's a contract? If it's taken as a contract, what's going to happen if you haven't signed that last page? Somebody's going to come in with an AK-47 and start shooting holes in the ceiling, right? And you're going to go, Harry, it's really better if you don't bring automatic weapons to work, and especially while you're selling drugs. So please don't sell drugs and don't shoot up with your AK-47. And this is just a verbal warning, but I want you to know that we're a little upset about it. So, of course, the next day, the guy's doing cost-benefit in his mind. He's making $1,200 a day selling dope, right? And nobody's bothering him because he's waving the Uzi around or the AK-47. And he comes back in again. Harry, do you remember we talked about this yesterday? I think I'm going to have to write up a written warning and put it in your employee file, et cetera. That's what's going to happen if you have it as required by the handbook and no sign off on the last page. We use progressive discipline, right? You have to have outs. One thing they have is we use progressive discipline if it's not serious, or they just have that last page that says nothing relates to a contract, right? Or both, right? That allows them to fire the guy who's shooting up the ceiling with an AK-47.
But if you shoot Harry, then you don't have to worry about it.
There is that.
See?
Have you ever shot myself once? I was shooting a BB gun into a bowl, and the pellet went in, whipped around the pole, and came back and hit me right in the throat. I know. It was pretty damn maddening.
Hey,
I busted that gun right in the head.
Top track.
Shoot your eye out,
that.
Right?
Top track can't even do that.
No, it's pretty tricky.
Is that a metal bowl?
No, it's plastic, actually, now that I remember it. Yeah, and it went around. Those pellet guns don't have any power. So anyway, what we're looking at here then is making sure that everybody understands what you understand about the protections that employees have, concerted activities, two or more employees, handbook exceptions, blah, 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 blah. All that stuff means that you need to be very wary about firing employees. Be careful. If you have some particular angst that you want to burn off, don't take it out on employees. All right, that's it. I'm sure I've forgotten stuff I should have talked about, but that's a lot. Huh? Yeah, I know, because I'm forgetful. See, there's an advantage to taking old professors. They tend to forget shit that they're supposed to be talking.
Well, now, and I feel like they could say I'm always done. I've had some really